Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon, an organization that provides disaster relief across the globe, from responding to earthquakes in Haiti to hurricanes in New York City. Team Rubicon is a group of veterans who are applying the skills they used in war zones, such as Iraq and Afghanistan, to disaster situations elsewhere. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What does Team Rubicon do?
So, you know, Team Rubicon is really focused on taking veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and finding a way for them to continue to serve. And, you know, what we do is we organize, train, and deploy them for disaster relief. You know, we found a lot of lessons that were learned on the battlefield are applicable in disaster zones, and we feel like there's a lot of synergy there that can, you know, benefit from both sides.
Now, the catalyst for starting the organization was the earthquake in Haiti in January 2010. Where were you at that time?
You know, I had just gotten out of the Marine Corps, and I'd been out of the Marine Corps for about 3 months. I was living in Los Angeles. I'd been stationed in Southern California. That's what took me out there. And I was applying to go to grad school to get my MBA and was sitting on my couch in my apartment in Los Angeles when the earthquake happened. The joke is that I was sitting around in my underwear eating, you know, potato chips when it happened. And there's some truth to that, probably.
Now, you joke about, you know, being alone on your couch eating potato chips, but a lot of the experience of soldiers coming back from war is isolated and lonely. What was your personal experience being back?
Right. I mean, if I was alone eating potato chips on my couch when this happened, it wasn't because I was, you know, isolated and withdrawn socially after having come out of the military. It's not really fair to ask how my experience was coming out because, you know, in 3 months, it's very hard to determine. I got out of the Marine Corps. My then girlfriend, now wife, and I went to South America for, you know, a month and traveled South America. And I came back and it was the holidays and I was having fun and I was seeing family and friends. And so, you know, early January, I hadn't even thought about life as a civilian yet. And so then I went straight into Team Rubicon. I went straight to Haiti. And, you know, my wife jokes that I really never left, you know, the military. So it's kind of my experience transitioning out has been far from normal.
In a positive sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
When she jokes that you really have never left the military, how much of your wanting to go to Haiti was personally driven about, like, wanting to be back where you had been because of the adrenaline rush and the other things that go along with it?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to think back to what the emotions were that were going through that day. You know, I've always been the type of person that's wanted to help people. You know, that was one of my motivations for joining the military in the beginning. But, you know, I'd be a liar if I said there wasn't an element of excitement to it. There was a certain level of, you know, the rush. And you know, I still miss that. You know, whenever missions happen, I long for it, you know, and to be where the boots hit the ground.
So you see the earthquake in Haiti and you said, okay, I want to respond. What logistically did you do?
William and I had a couple of initial phone calls about what needed to happen in order to make it a reality.
And by the way, William McNulty, your co-founder.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so we had a couple of initial conversations. Of course, the first thing we had to do was get down to Haiti, you know, and that was problematic because they shut down the airport and only military planes were coming in and humanitarian designated planes. So we needed to raise money, get to Haiti, and then we needed, you know, shelter, food, and water. I mean, some of the basic necessities of doing anything in life. And so we were able to raise the money initially from social media.
Now, when you say social media, you posted your desire on Facebook?
Yeah, basically, once the decision was made, we put it to Facebook, which I guess, you know, nothing's official these days until it's on Facebook. And within, I'd say, 10 minutes, my future brother-in-law called me and offered to buy 4 round-trip tickets down to the Dominican Republic, which is where we had kind of decided we had to fly in and out of, as you know, because of this restricted airspace in Port-au-Prince. So that kind of made it a reality. We knew we could get, we may not be able to get to C, if C is Port-au-Prince, but we could get to B, which was right next door in the Dominican Republic.
So, and is that a military term, using those letters like that?
No, not at all.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm a big believer in you'll never get anywhere looking for the complete solution. You know, you always have to put yourself closer and closer to the problem, finding those incremental, you know, solutions. And so we knew we could get to the Dominican Republic, and at first we didn't know how we were going to get to the Dominican, from the Dominican to Haiti, but once you start putting those pieces in place, those other solutions, it opens doors. The next thing was, okay, security and where are we going to lay our head at night? And William went to a Jesuit high school in Chicago. For whatever reason, he thought it'd be a good idea to call someone at his former Jesuit high school. And it turns out it was a good idea. And we got put in touch with the Jesuits who were running a mission down in Port-au-Prince. And so we had a Jesuit brother, Brother Jim, drive from Port-au-Prince across the border and met us in the Santo Domingo, and then escorted us back into Haiti, over land.
So how much planning did you do from your couch in Los Angeles versus just learning by doing once you got down there?
We were probably, from the time we made the decision to go to the time we boarded planes to leave, was about 48 hours. You know, a lot of that was packing supplies and continuing to raise some money and set some of those things in place. And
how many were you?
Well, it started out with four. And en route down to the Dominican, we each recruited another member to the team while we were flying down. So William, for instance, was sitting on the tarmac at Dulles Airport. And a guy leans over and says, "Hey, you look like you're about to go do something crazy in Haiti." And William, you know, was kind of taken aback, but he said, "Yeah, you're right. I'm going down." And he goes, "Oh, I was a former Army Special Forces medic. I've got experience in Haiti working for a security company, and I'm going down there to help myself. Mind if I join?" And so we added that guy, Mark Hayward. And then I added an ER doctor that I met in Santo Domingo at the baggage claim. And it just kind of rolled up from there.
How were you received? Did you ask permission from certain organizations before you went down?
Yeah. So again, William, you know, kept making a lot of pieces fall in place. He was in D.C. when this all was going down. And, you know, in those 48 hours that we were preparing, he just walked up to both the Dominican and the Haitian embassies on Embassy Row and probably oversold what it was that we were doing and capable of. But he got signed letters from both ambassadors to the U.S. guaranteeing, you know, the safe passage across the border and that none of our supplies were to be confiscated or anything like that. And so, yes, technically we were invited and we had these permissions. I think that we probably took advantage of the, you know, the chaos of the situation a little bit.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon, an organization comprised of former veterans. These volunteers apply their military experience to emergency situations, working as first responders internationally. When did it occur to you that the situation in Haiti resembled the disaster situations, the ambiguity, the human tragedy, the mismanagement that you had experienced out in the field in the war zone?
I mean, from the moment we crossed the border checkpoint was complete chaos. There was really no control happening. You could just pass and go as you saw fit. But as you got closer and closer and closer to Port-au-Prince, the density of suffering just increased. There was just still this dust in the air from all the rubble. And it was literally like a fog, but it was this chalky dust. And you could still hear people crying and wailing. And we were in pickup trucks at that point and moving 6 miles an hour through these streets, people coming up and trying to pull supplies off of the back of your truck. And we were getting in there right at twilight. And so it was about to go dark. We made it to the compound right as the sun went down. And, we rolled into this Jesuit compound. They had a guard at the door with a shotgun. And, you know, we did a quick perimeter check to see how secure it was. And we bedded down for the night. But shortly after arriving and starting to bed down, one of the doctors that had joined the team was approached. And there was a woman or a little girl with her mother who had an open and compound fracture in her leg, you know, meaning that her femur had broken so badly that the bone was coming out through the skin. And it had been like that, of course, for 4 days. So 20 minutes after arriving, our doctors were doing, you know, basic battlefield surgery almost. And without anesthesia, this poor girl was sitting there and she was screaming and wailing. And that was kind of a welcome to Port-au-Prince.
You were kind of struck by the similarity in the Middle East. But how much was the fact that your life was not at risk to the same degree part of your experience?
It was interesting. I was in the Marine Corps Infantry for one tour with a rifle squad in Anbar Province, Iraq, during the surge. Saw the full range of kinetic activity that a Marine rifle squad can experience. My second tour, I was a scout sniper on a sniper team in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, which was the most volatile area of Afghanistan for the last, really, for the last 4 years. So I'd been in danger. You know, I'd been in mortal danger for pretty much the prior 4 years of my life. So it was interesting to be in an area where there was so much need for help and a similar need, and in many ways, similar, you know, sensory activity with smells and sights and sounds and all of that, but not having to feel like there was an ambush around every corner. I mean, there was danger. There's a lot of criminal activity in Port-au-Prince. It's a very dangerous city. Nobody's going there for holidays, but I mean, it was relieving. I think my friend Clay kind of said it best. He talked about how it was renewed his sense of humanity a little bit. You know, even in a place like Port-au-Prince, which on a normal day is pretty dangerous, you know, the worst catastrophe in modern history befalls them and they become more human. They're helping one another. They're putting down grudges and longstanding rivalries to help dig each other out or provide water and food for one another. And we're gracious to our help.
By the way, William, your co-founder, William McNulty, how did you meet him?
Hey, we always joke about how it was kind of like Match.com. You know, we had been put in touch with one another about a year prior to the earthquake. We had never met, kind of had a mutual acquaintance who thought that we kind of thought alike. You know, we had only had some cursory conversations prior to Haiti. So Santo Domingo, Dominican, was the first time we ever shook hands.
Yet he was the first person you called to want to get down there.
Well, he actually called me. So it's kind of a funny story. I went through, initially, I called all the guys that had been in my sniper team in Afghanistan. And either they hadn't yet figured out that there was an earthquake that hit Port-au-Prince, or they didn't have a passport. The irony of being able to deploy to Iraq and Afghanistan is you don't need a passport. I was dumbfounded that they either didn't know what was going on and I had to yell at them to turn on the TV and turn it to CNN for once in their lives, or they didn't have a passport. Actually, the first person I got a hold of was my college roommate, who was the firefighter up in Wisconsin. He didn't hesitate to say that you know, he was willing to go. And then after I put it on Facebook, I got a call from William.
Isn't it interesting how, you know, these accidents happen?
Right.
The accident of your co-founding Team Rubicon was through, you know, an introduction by a friend.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes you can't discount some of those, you know, those minor events that happen. You know, one of our mantras early at TR was to, you know, never say no. You know, say yes to everything, because you never know who's going to play out and help or be a critical, you know, component of the team moving forward.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon. We'll hear more from Jake coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon, an organization comprised of former veterans. These volunteers apply their military experience to emergency situations, working as first responders internationally. And by the way, the organization now is comprised of not just veterans, but other volunteers. Is that correct?
Yeah. So we have about 80% of our volunteers are veterans. The other 20 are a lot of firefighters, you know, some doctors and medics and first responders, and, you know, a few well-meaning civilians slip in as well.
At what point did you decide to formalize or institutionalize the organization after Haiti?
You know, the whole story is just really funny. We had no intention of starting an organization when we went down to Haiti. We just wanted to go and help. We thought it was something that we'd, you know, tell at the bar, you know, as a one-upper story for the rest of our lives. But you know, while we were down there, we started to see the impact we could have, but I still don't think it really hit us. But you know, we had kind of a sensationalist story. This group of military veterans running around Port-au-Prince, you know, outside the big UN cluster system, and providing a lot of real meaningful aid in a very transparent way, and using social media to tell that story. So we started to get this really large following online out of nowhere overnight, and that propelled a lot of money to come in. And so my dad took a week off of work. He's you know, the vice president of manufacturing for a, you know, small factory up in Iowa, and he was running our command operations center from our house in Iowa.
What's his name?
Jeff Wood. So we were raising this money, and you know, I'd have a weekly or a nightly or every other night phone call with my dad to check in and see, okay, hey, we have more teams coming down from Chicago. They're arriving at noon tomorrow. We have these pieces coming in from Miami and supplies coming in from Pittsburgh. And there's a lot of moving pieces that really, you know, snowballed. And one night my dad called me and we kind of went through the general brief that we'd been going through. And then he said, oh, by the way, I got a phone call from a lawyer who was a former Marine up in Minnesota. And he just incorporated you today as a 501c3. And I said, Dad, what the hell is a 501c3? I had no idea. And he said, it's a nonprofit organization and you're the president. I said, well, that's not in the plan. Why? And he said, well, because of all the money that's been raised, it was through my personal PayPal account. And I was going to be liable for taxes and all these things. And so the IRS, to their credit, did a great job of realizing that this was such an out of the ordinary event that they were very good about allowing organizations that kind of popped up to, you know, retroactively give charitable credit for donations that came in before those 501c3 paperwork was established. So, I mean, the IRS actually did a really good job post Haiti of being flexible, yeah, which they're not exactly known for. So that's how we found ourselves, William and I, on the board of directors for a nonprofit that didn't exist, you know, 12 hours before the Haiti earthquake.
And how did you come to the name?
Right before we pushed out to Port-au-Prince, William called me and said, I think we should give this a name. It's starting to get a little traction, and Marines always want to name everything that they do. So we started bouncing it back and forth, but the Rubicon was a river that separated ancient Rome and Gaul, and Roman legions weren't allowed to cross it because it was considered an act of war. Crossing the Rubicon has come to mean the point of no return, or crossing to the point of no return. And there's a river that separates part of the Dominican from Haiti as a border. And so we kind of treated that border crossing as our Rubicon. There were no longer any excuses. There were a ton of excuses for us not to go all along the way that people were telling us, all these reasons. But we knew that as soon as we crossed that border, we were going to be committed.
By the way, you mentioned before that one of your mantras or rules was never say no.
Yeah.
Generally.
Yeah, I mean, that more had to do with, like, meeting people and you know, take this meeting or meet that person for coffee, even if it didn't seem to make sense. We say no a lot, just to get that clear.
And so how is that applied in your personal life? Do you tend to have a posture of openness?
Yeah. You know, I've always been a really forward-leaning person. You know, a lot of people, they find reasons not to do something, or they see obstacles instead of opportunities. And we took this position of, we will meet with every single person that we can. And it doesn't matter if they're, you know, selling, you know, pink lemonade in Philadelphia. If they ask us to go out for coffee, we're going to do it.
We talk about the Rubicon and you're having a forward-leaning posture. What for you was the reason to go into a life in the military? You don't have family in the military.
I'd always been interested in the military in high school and was thinking about joining then. And turned out I was a decent high school football player. And so I started getting a lot of scholarship opportunities to go and play college football. And that shifted my priorities a little bit, and I wanted to go be a pro football player. And so
you went to the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah, so I ended up taking a full scholarship to University of Wisconsin instead of you know, going to either a military academy or just joining the Marines right out of high school, which had always kind of been a plan of mine. And so I went to college fall of 2001, and 6 weeks in or 4 weeks into college freshman classes, 9/11 happened. I thought about dropping out, you know, a month into college and joining. I didn't. I made excuses not to go. And over the course of the next 2 years, my college career didn't pan out from a football perspective like I'd hoped. And then going into my senior year, Pat Tillman was killed in Afghanistan, who had been a pro football player that walked away from $9 million to join the Army. That profoundly impacted my life. And so I made the decision the day I saw the ticker come across the screen that he'd been killed, that I was going to join.
And here's somebody who played football in college and who sold life insurance one summer.
Me?
Right? Yeah.
How the hell did you know that? That actually paid enormous dividends.
Tell me how selling life insurance paid enormous dividends.
You know, there is not a harder sales gig in the world than selling life insurance. But it's paid a lot of dividends.
Why do you keep saying that? Why?
Well, I mean, my whole it's equally difficult to try to get people to invest in a startup nonprofit where they're never going to see their money come back. And that's really what we were. In essence, I had to go to angel investors and say, hey, write me a check for $50,000 for this idea called Team Rubicon. The only promise I have is that you'll never see your money again. You know, even in the social sector, foundations are not quick to write checks to organizations less than 3 years old. And a lot of them, you know, saw Team Rubicon as a flash in the pan, one-hit wonder from Haiti, and didn't think that we'd 50 missions later be, you know, still kicking ass. So.
You mentioned before your friend Clay. You were his best man at his wedding. He was a former Marine. Mm-hmm. And after the war, he took his life in 2011 due to this difficult transition to civilian life. And there's a quote he said, "Marines are at war and Americans are at the mall." Mm-hmm. To what extent is Team Rubicon a place for former veterans to go to have a sense of purpose, to be able to make themselves useful?
Yeah, I mean, that's really what it's all about now. Over the first year, we thought the organization was just going to be a disaster response organization. But what we saw was that these veterans who were participating in that were coming home and saying that it was, you know, the most valuable experience that they'd had since they took off their uniform. And concurrent to that, we had a lot of veterans who were asking to get involved with Team Rubicon who, for whatever reason, they didn't have the necessary skill set to go, say, and train medics in Burma, you know, along the Thai-Burma border. Maybe they were a truck driver in the military or a nuclear biochemical specialist in the Navy, and we just didn't need that. But they were expressing this desire to be a part of something again. And so, you know, right around this time is when Clay killed himself, and we realized that there was this opportunity for us to become more than just a disaster response organization, but to be an organization that provides purpose and community and, you know, identity for veterans who are longing for that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon, an organization comprised of former veterans. These volunteers apply their military experience to emergency situations, working as first responders internationally. There's a company called Palantir, which addresses big data mm-hmm. and helping organizations and companies sift through just large information. How are you using Palantir at Team Rubicon?
Yeah, so Palantir is actually one of those just never say no stories. I was speaking at an event in San Diego, and after the event, I got approached by this guy named Brian Fishman, who worked on their philanthropy team, and he approached me, reached out, shook my hand, said, "Great talk." And anyway, we have a great talk. The guy's very genuine, and over the course of the next 4 weeks, we had some, you know, some just high-level discussions about what Palantir might do for us. And I just still didn't get it. Mm. Then Hurricane Sandy happened, maybe a month and a half after we had met. And he calls me, and he just keeps calling me and calling me three times a day during the first 5 days of that response. And I'm actually pretty frustrated that he's continuing to bother me. And he just keeps saying, like, "Let us go to New York, and I'll show you what we can do." And I said, "Fly to JFK, be there by 9 p.m. I'll have a van pick you up. Bring all the equipment you need. Don't screw it up," you know, or something like that. And he showed up, and you know, when they land and they show up at our forward operating base, I get a phone call from our team leader on the ground. He goes, "Who are these geeks?" And he didn't get it either. And you know, listen, fast forward 48 hours, Brian Fishman and this team of engineers from Palantir start making us look like the smartest guys in the room. And it's only because we just didn't say no, although we were tempted to.
So what exactly do they do?
I didn't even get to the question. So we will go into a disaster zone with a bunch of mobile devices. So we send out these assessment teams immediately after a tornado, say. And they go street by street, house by house, and they are inputting information into this mobile device. So we might go through a neighborhood, two different neighborhoods, and one has suffered catastrophic damage and one has suffered medium scale damage, but both are uninhabitable. You might say that go after the catastrophic damage first because it's worse damage. It's going to take more work. But if we layer in, say, U.S. Census data, which Palantir can do, and then heat map the levels of damage against, say, elderly populations or poverty levels, then we can say, well, actually, although the damage is less significant over here in this neighborhood, this is a more vulnerable population, so we need to pour resources here first because they're not going to be able to get back onto their feet as easy. This will bankrupt them if they don't come in and get free yet professional labor.
I want to shift to your personal life. You mentioned that you grew up in Iowa. Mm-hmm. Your father is a vice president at a manufacturing company. Mm-hmm. What does he manufacture?
They manufacture laboratory equipment, specifically calorimeters, so devices that measure energy output. So you put, like, say, food in it, and you put it, make it, you pump oxygen, and then you burn it, and it measures the caloric output of it.
Caloric.
Caloric, no. Like calories.
And your mom?
My mom's been a stay-at-home mom my whole life. I've been very lucky.
How many siblings do you have?
I've got three sisters, two older and one younger.
What was your family's response when you told them that you wanted to go into the military, into the Marines?
They were devastated. Take, for instance, my dad. I think he was, to be blunt, I think he was a little pissed off. I certainly know now he understands.
What has surprised you about your Team Rubicon experience, like running the organization? And also, what has surprised you about your experience just like being out there on the ground?
Boy, there's a couple things that jump out at me. I think on the international side, there's this aversion to anything not humanitarian. And so that means that there are all these humanitarian organizations that that loathe Team Rubicon because of our military roots. Mm. They have a natural mistrust of the military. And coupled with that, you know, there's a lot of business practices, best practices that just, for whatever reason, whether they have the same poor opinion of big business, but they just refuse to adopt. And you would think that there would be, you know, just simple things like the adoption of universal cloud computing platforms that would enable a cluster in Manila and a cluster in Tacloban to have access to the same information in real time. But there isn't. And it's and you have these people that are handing in paper forms with information on different formats that get taken in, and then nothing happens with it. Nobody collates it. Nobody uploads it to the cloud for universal access. Nobody's certainly mapping it geospatially. And these are things that the military has been doing for years. These are simple, you know, SaaS platforms that any business can have access to for $10 a month.
SaaS being software and as a service.
Right.
Yep.
So that's one of the things that kind of shocks me, just this mistrust that's placed at both at corporate America and at the military for possibly having, you know, useful ideas that can help improve what's happening. Drilling down to kind of a boots on the ground perspective, I think one of the things that frustrates me is that there's this instant fear of what the security situation on the ground is. There's always this assumption made that if it's a country that's, you know, non-Western, civil society is going to be suspended and they're going to be clawing at each other's eyes. In the Philippines, for instance, you know, the health cluster run by the World Health Organization was, you know, directing people to set up these static clinics, you know, at like this community center or this school gymnasium. Well, that's great, but if you had your leg broken in a massive typhoon, you're not going to walk 3 miles to a community center to be seen. And the reason they were directing people to start these static clinics is they could put security at them. And we've always seen that you have to be mobile and move out into the community in order to get them the aid that they need. So the concern should always be there. Don't get me wrong. We're always concerned about safety, but we don't misinterpret desperate, starving people as security threats. We think that they're just simply desperate, starving people.
Now that you are deeply embedded in Team Rubicon and you're back in civil society, how does your experience having been in the Marines and now helping with disaster situations elsewhere impact even just your quotidian life? How often do you use your experiences there as references for the way you go about your day?
Yeah, I find myself doing that all the time. You know, hopefully my wife doesn't listen to this podcast, but I eat, sleep, and breathe, you know, Team Rubicon, except for when I'm with you, Indra. Love you. But, you know, I lean on the things I learned in the military all the time. You know, I have no formal training in entrepreneurship. I have a business degree as an undergrad, but we all know that's kind of a joke. And, you know, the ideas of how to formulate plans and objectives and you know, formulating strategy but focusing on tactics. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think the one thing that most Marines, and I can really only speak to the Marine Corps, get out of their service in the Marine Corps is this attitude, this attitude of mission accomplishment and overcoming odds to, you know, to achieve objectives.
You mentioned your wife. She has not been to the places you've been. How often are you referring to your time in the military when you are together, and how does she feel about
it? It's interesting, you know, because of my experiences in the military, I look at things much more objectively. Everyday life situations present themselves. I often can revert to this, you know, perhaps cold calculus of what needs to happen. You know, if you're told in the Marine Corps that you need to storm that trench that has two machine guns in it that's firing at you, you approach that mission with the objective knowledge that you're probably going to lose some men in the attempt. And, you know, in civilian life, we would just say, well, you know what, the trench isn't worth taking. There can be simple things that pop up in life where I my wife tells me I need to look at these much with more subjectivity or empathy, and she'll usually, you know, smack me in the arm and tell me to snap out of it and stop being Sergeant Wood and be Jake. So it happens.
I feel like you're not robotic, but your very tough stance when you first met me has sort of melted away a little bit now. And now I see, oh, this was like Jake pre-military.
Was I asking Jake when I walked in?
You weren't Jake, but you were no-nonsense Jake. And that's fine. But it's nice to see how your posture has gotten softer over the course of this interview, which is natural in general.
I know it's something I need to work on. Everybody tells me I have a scowl. So I need to work on my scowl. That's what I got in my 360 feedback interviews from people.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Jake Wood. Coming up, we'll meet John Oringer, founder of Shutterstock. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is John Oringer, founder of Shutterstock, an online marketplace for images, video clips, and music. The content is crowdsourced, with photographers, artists, and other contributors uploading their content in exchange for a percent of revenue when their work is purchased. John started Shutterstock in 2003, and the company went public in 2012. John lives in New York City, where Shutterstock is headquartered. Welcome.
Thanks.
You grew up in Scarsdale, New York. What do your parents do?
My dad was a science teacher, New Rochelle. My mom taught special ed in Yonkers.
And how would they describe you?
I think I was a curious kid. I was constantly taking things apart, putting them back together, trying to build stuff. I was always interested in how things worked. And once I started learning how to code, started to realize I can tell a computer what to do, I found that to be fascinating.
You had a few odd jobs, you know, as you were growing up. You did fix people's computers.
Yep.
You taught guitar. And the interesting thing, actually, about your guitar is that you wanted to teach guitar, so you learned how to play guitar first so that you could teach it.
Yeah, well, it actually turned out, and I think a lot of teachers would say this, that the best way to learn something is actually to try to teach it. So I started putting up flyers around Scarsdale with little pull-off tabs with my phone number on it, and I quickly learned how to kind of put together a couple of lessons.
You went to Stony Brook for college, and then you pursued a master's at Columbia in computer science. What were some of the jobs that you held after graduating?
Actually, I never really got a job. I had this skill I could program. So even in high school, what I was doing was I was creating little kind of Windows applications. At the time, Windows was the most popular operating system. And if I could create something that people would spend some money on, that was kind of exciting. So I started to look for problems people had. One of those problems were pop-ups, these kind of annoying advertisements that would interfere with your web browsing. The first one was kind of a security and privacy tool. When cookies were starting to become an issue, people were afraid they were being tracked. In the beginning of all these businesses, I would do every part of them. I was a customer service rep. I was the programmer. I was the designer. I did QA.
You also, after college, you tried to start a dating site.
Yeah, there were a whole bunch of different sites that I kind of iterated through. And turns out there was a lot of competition in the dating website world. the website that I created with a few friends didn't take off, so we kind of ditched it pretty quickly.
What was it called?
It was called Particular Personals.
What were some other companies that you kind of tried and failed at or were working on before you launched Shutterstock?
One was a legal services firm that would monitor people's trademarks. That worked for a little while, made some revenue, didn't really go far. But what it would do is it would monitor a trademark that you registered. As other people were registering things that maybe sounded like it or could infringe on it, since as a trademark owner, it's your responsibility to defend those and to find them yourself, this tool would find it for you. Turned out there was a lot of competition in that space too.
What was your parents' view of what you were doing, even before, you know, starting Shutterstock, coding and trying to start internet companies? More than 10, I think you tried?
Yeah, I think they knew that I could be self-sufficient and I would be fine because there was cash coming into my account usually doing something. But they probably didn't quite know what to think. But there were a couple of dynamics going on. I did not want to get a job. In fact, mm-hmm. I was pretty sure I wasn't employable. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I was going to be able to last anywhere even if I got a job.
Did you ever have a conventional job?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I probably for a couple of days delivered pizza in high school. So I kind of knew deep down I had to figure something else out. I always knew I could fall back on an hourly gig of fixing people's computers. And I also knew that if I needed to get a job as a software developer, I could find that. So that kind of took some risk out of the equation. Mm-hmm. It allowed me to pursue and fail. And so I just kept iterating through everything I could find. I used every website I could find. I used every product I could find.
Mm-hmm.
I became kind of like an online expert in everything that was being developed out there. What I realized is that when I was marketing all of these products, it was hard to find images.
That was the germ, in a way, for Shutterstock, because, as you're saying, you needed images to go along with the content to make it more appealing to potential customers. And you started to create images yourself. You bought a camera and went out and just shot hundreds of thousands of photographs. At what point were you thinking, you know what, this is going to be yet another business that I'm going to try?
Well, at that point, the pop-up blocker sort of went right out of business because Microsoft built it for free into Internet Explorer, which turned out to be a very successful failure for me because it let me kind of sit back and think about what else I could create. I knew I was interested in photography, but I also knew that as an internet marketer, there was no real resource out there to easily get images. There was this rights managed model where lots of photos were sold under at the time, where you had to tell this calculator where you were going to use the image, how you're using the image, how long you're using the image for, what territory. The internet has no territory. When you put an image out on the internet, the whole world is going to see it. And you can't just pay for the United States, for instance, like you could in the print world. You know, I looked at lots of these stock photo companies and tried to figure out, could I create this content? Mm-hmm. If I spent a whole year just creating content, would I be able to compete with these sites? I bought a digital SLR. I bought a Canon Digital Rebel in 2003. It was one of the first digital SLRs to drop below $1,000. And I would just shoot everything around me. And I iteratively became a stock photographer really quick. I started to put these shots on a website called Shutterstock and charge a one-time fee for them per month. Download whatever you need. And the images actually started to fly off the shelves. I was watching the data that came in on the companies that were buying, and it was companies of all sizes. I realized I wasn't the only one having this mm-hmm. problem. The images I created were not that great. I mean, I was not a good photographer.
What were some of them?
They were the coffee mug that I was drinking out of in the morning. They were people walking down the street. If I found a cool spot to take pictures of New York City, I would go to a roof deck and do that. It was everything I could find around me, including my friends, who I eventually talked into signing model releases.
You mentioned that you were surprised by the response. Was there one or two particular visitors or customers who bought and you thought, oh, wow, Dunkin' Donuts even wants to use this? It lent some credibility to it?
I don't remember too many specifics, but I do remember that I recognized the companies coming in. They were agencies that when I Googled them and I looked up the business, they represented companies that I understood what was going on at that point. The people that were buying my images had no other option.
We mentioned your guitar playing before, and, you know, I thought about, you know, how you learned how to play guitar in order to teach it, just as you learned how to take photos in order to sell them.
I think that's an important part of kind of these businesses that I started, is that I was always the first customer. I was always trying to figure out how to get the images that now I was going to try to supply the world with.
You see that demand is higher than you might have thought. What came next?
The demand started to outstrip the supply. I was able to create tens of thousands of images. I realized quickly I needed millions. So if I was able to not be the only contributor and create an open-sourced kind of crowdsourced model where anyone could sell, could I do the math here and figure it out? And I settled on 25 images a day. It seemed like at that rate, a single user was able to get everything they needed throughout a month. And then I could back into a calculation where I could pay out 30% of everything that was coming in to contributors. And at that point, I was able to kind of open up the marketplace to both sides.
We take for granted the words like crowdsource. Oh, I crowdsourced it. But, you know, that's not a term that was ubiquitous or well known in the vernacular in early 2000s. How did you source from the crowd?
I started with online forums. I found these forums of people that were photographers helping each other out to create a better shot. So the kind of idea I had at that point was I contacted a few of them and I said, you guys are creating images just like I am. I'm making this much money off them. Would you like to too? And if you'd like to refer your friends, I'll pay you for the referrals too. So I started to kind of create some influencers. At the time, they were excited about being able to monetize something that they were never able to monetize before.
You have 70,000 contributors. Who were the first one or two? What was their profile?
They were all people that loved photography but had something else as their main job. So they were hobbyist photographers that wanted to get better at doing what they were doing. They wanted to buy that next lens that has always been expensive. This was the thing that they would do the second they left work. That was the profile.
Now, what is the range of income that, you know, a contributor might experience?
Contributors make anywhere from a few dollars a month to hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. There are definitely small businesses that have been created. There are definitely sole proprietors that are making more than they did at their jobs now.
Mm-hmm. What was like a pivot moment for you? I mean, you saw from the inception that there was real demand and you got contributors to buy in. Was there a pivot moment for you where, you know, things started to escalate even more so?
The moment that this started to, that I started to realize that this could work was when I was able to get supply in that met demand. Mm. And that's important because the entire marketplace is kind of organically driven, right? And I didn't realize this at first, but what was happening was contributors would come in, they would upload some images, and they would watch what was happening. In real time, they would get paid. They would watch what was getting sold, and then they would create more images like that. And when I started to see that happen, I started to realize that the entire marketplace, what was going to be critical was that I need to keep that connection going because otherwise the contributors are never going to know what the buyers want and vice versa. So there were other agencies that started at the time where this wasn't the case. And it's important that's there because that's what creates the network effect.
And what was going on with John Oringer, like your personal life at the time while all this is happening?
I was starting to get used to the fact that I wasn't a one-man show anymore and I had to learn how to manage people. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be pretty difficult. I suddenly went from never working in an office to having a whole group of people that were my employees.
And having to get out of your pajamas if you needed to,
yeah.
Right? I mean, you're at home.
I was working from home. So now I was starting to have an office I would go to every day.
From the get-go, you did not raise venture capital, partly because you didn't need it. Or was that wholly because you didn't need it?
It was because I didn't need it. It was also because I didn't know how to get it. It was also because New York was not a place where people, where venture capitalists understood tech companies. So I was able to kind of stay under the radar for many years and kind of and build this company that was constantly profitable because I had made it really efficient.
And at what point did people start to recognize you as well? I mean, they're generating a lot of revenue. You have an IPO in 2012, and 6 months after, you're over $1 billion in market cap. When did the industry start recognizing you, even before the IPO?
Well, photographers also always knew about us, and designers did too, but it's a pretty concentrated world of people. We're a business-to-business product, so we don't show up on consumer screens. By 2008, just about every graphic designer around knew about us. A lot of businesses knew about us. Around 2010 is when people started to notice. And then around 2012 was when we went public, and then there was no going back.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is John Oringer, founder of Shutterstock, a crowdsourced marketplace for photos, illustrations, graphics, video clips, and music. The company has over 50 million images that small businesses, corporations, and other users can purchase at affordable prices. John launched Shutterstock in 2003, and the company went public in fall 2012. John has been called Silicon Alley's first billionaire, meaning that Shutterstock was the first tech company launched in New York City to earn a market cap of above $1 billion. And John's owning more than 50% of the company, thus made you the first new Silicon Alley billionaire. But it's ironic that you took no venture capital, because Silicon Alley is, we think of as, you know, these venture-backed companies.
Yeah, it is. We did do a private equity round with Insight.
Later.
But in the beginning, I kind of didn't want someone telling me how to run the business. It was always important to me to have complete control over what was going on and be as independent as possible.
You're now in more than 150 countries and in over 20 languages. What cultural dynamics do you recognize? Are there any kind of patterns that you see, let's say, in the Netherlands versus New York versus Japan?
Yeah, we're all over the world.
Yeah.
And we answer the phones in New York in 20 different languages. And we translated the site into Japanese as the first language. And what happened was we were able to sell images in a country that we didn't have any customer support for, completely self-serve product, just by translating the website. And so once we realized that, we translated the site into 20 different languages from there. The search part of the website is important. And we have a whole team of people trying to make sure that your search is local, your search is relevant to where you're searching from. If someone in Japan searches for food, you want sushi to come up. If someone in the U.S. searches for food, you want hamburger to show up or something relevant.
Do you recognize the site's own images out there in the world?
Yeah. Anywhere from a blog to an online news publication to a billboard would be using our images. Hollywood Films use our video.
So what's an example of some films or TV shows? I mean, House of Cards is one. What are some other examples?
With stock video, what you can do is you can use something that may have been hard to create as a transition, for instance. So documentaries tend to use a city time lapse from sunrise to sunset really quickly. So we have every city on Shutterstock, and so documentaries use a lot of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting more and more popular for websites to use video.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting more popular for advertising to use video. And it's getting more popular for Hollywood to start using stock video, because we're getting such amazing creative stuff. And it's very well priced.
You're a helicopter pilot. Why are you interested in helicopters?
I've always been interested in helicopters and flying and how they work. And in 2010, I decided to take a helicopter lesson. I always wanted to do it, and I took that lesson and I realized this is something I want to learn. I want to get a license to be able to fly this thing on my own. It took a while. It took like a year, year and a half. I went through kind of the entire training that any helicopter pilot would go through. It took me a little longer because I also have the day job to deal with, but it was awesome and I love it. I still do it up till today.
You're also taking drumming lessons.
I'm always looking for kind of fun things to learn that are outside the scope of what I do every day. Both flying a helicopter and playing drums, they're both super tedious to learn. So you have to put all of your concentration into it. I find that when I'm able to get into something like that, that kind of distraction helps me with the other parts of my job and my life.
Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been John Orringer. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.